Hello and welcome to the RBC podcast, Veterinary Science on the Move. My name is Matthias Kleins, and today we will be talking to Professor Josh Slater and Professor Ken Smith about their research on equine strangles. Strangles is a contagious upper respiratory tract infection of horses and other equids caused by the bacterium Streptococcus equi, which is endemic in domesticated horse populations worldwide. Clinically, the disease is characterized by general inappetence, fever, nasal discharge, and swollen or enlarged lymph nodes in the neck and face region. Well, thank you, Josh, and thank you, Ken, for joining us here today and talk about strangles in the horse. As a first question, it would be interesting to ask you, Josh, what the general importance of strangles in equine medicine actually is.
Strangles, that's infections caused by Streptococcus equi, are actually extremely important. There's I think a temptation to see them as being of historical significance only, and it's certainly true that they perhaps were at their most significant at the turn of the last century, with the large armies in Europe assembling huge numbers of horses for use in the First World War, and there were certainly very large outbreaks of disease at that time. That these infections are just as important and just as prevalent today as they were 100 years ago, and in fact, if you look back in the literature, these things have been significant right from the dawn of veterinary medicine, and there are excellent descriptions in the medieval literature of outbreaks of strangles. If you look at the data we have, the Animal Health Trust in Newmarket, the International Collating Centre which operates there, record the prevalence of infectious diseases, and in fact strep equi infections are consistently amongst the most common infectious diseases which are recorded there. So these things are historically significant, and they remain significant, possibly the most significant infectious diseases of horses right around the world today.
So with your work involved in biosecurity for the Olympic Games in Beijing, you also have to worry about strangles.
Yes, the strangles is one of the diseases which is specified on the Hong Kong government health import certificate. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the diseases which horses are required to be certified free from. As we'll come to later in this podcast, one of the concerns is how we control the possible introduction of strangles into those competition horses by importing a clinically normal but carrier horse.
Oh, okay. So we can touch upon that later maybe,
yes.
But I think a good step tackling that problem is to talk to a pathologist. Ken, what do you know about the mechanisms, how strangles infect horses, how they cause disease, and how, well, in the ideal case, a horse can actually protect itself from the disease?
Yes, thank you for that question and picking up on what Josh has said. Strangles is an important disease in horses, an important infection in horses, but important largely because it has evolved quite sophisticated mechanisms for causing disease. So this is a gram-positive bacterium, similar genetically to the other streptococci which cause sore throats in ourselves and the variety of other inflammatory respiratory diseases in horses. The unusual aspect of Streptococcus equi is that after infecting the respiratory mucosa, whether that be in the nasal cavity or the paranasal sinuses and the guttural pouches of horses, the infection spreads rapidly to the lymph nodes and recruits neutrophils to the lymph nodes, but then is able to evade phagocytosis and killing by the neutrophils. So the progressive accumulation of neutrophils within the lymph nodes causes the lymph nodes to enlarge and eventually to abscessate commonly across the skin surface. And it's because of this enlargement and the discomfort caused to the horse, particularly in the upper respiratory tract, that the disease has its name of equine strangles. So in the acute infection, the abscessation and the release of exudate is associated with a reduction in clinical signs. But as Josh has mentioned, the particular challenge in respect of this infection is that in a relatively high proportion of horses, the infection is succeeded by the development of a carrier state. So a horse or a pony which has no clinical signs of having strangles, but nonetheless has a persistent infection. And again, excellent work by the Animal Health Trust in Newmarket and other collaborators has illustrated that that carrier state is largely associated with persistence of the infection in the guttural pouches of the horse, which, as you will recall, are the outpouchings of the nasopharyngeal tubes, unusual to the horse and to a small number of other species. But in respect of persistent infection, blind-ending sacs, able to be accessed via the endoscope by the veterinary surgeon, and work at the Trust and elsewhere has illustrated that in the carrier horse, it is possible in some of these animals to detect inspissated pus, or chondroids, so-called, within the guttural pouches within which the bacteria are contained. And these carrier horses, despite having no clinical signs, often require quite prolonged antibiotic treatment to clear that infection and thereby reduce the risk, as Josh alluded to, of the carrier horse acting as a source of infection for other horses.
So there seems to be the possibility that a horse develops natural immunity, but what exactly is the mechanism how, in some horses, those carrier horses, the pathogen can actually evade the host response to cause this persistent infection which is going along with the formation of abscess?
There is excellent work accumulating in the molecular area looking at which parts of the pathogen, which genes and which proteins are associated with stimulating the particular arms of the immune system. And this is an area where Josh and his collaborators have done particularly good work, I think.
The key property these organisms have, I think, as Ken has said, is this ability to evade phagocytosis, because once that happens, then all of the sequelae, including abscess formation, but ultimately possibly the death of the horse, all result from the ability of these organisms to avoid being phagocytosed and killed. And we know quite a lot about the mechanisms that the bacterium has that allows it to do this, and we know, in common with all of the streps which have been studied, including the medical group A streptococci, that the capsule, which is a hyaluronic acid capsule, and one of the surface proteins of the organism, the M protein, are both key in allowing this to happen. It seems that they have complementary mechanisms. The capsule prevents the binding of opsonizing antibody to the surface structure of the organism, essentially a physical cloak, whereas the M protein binds fibrinogen, which again blocks antibody binding sites and also complement binding sites on the surface of the organism. And it's important to remember that although we probably all have this image in our minds of phagocytes circulating around ready to nail any organisms that they come across,
you need those antibodies to tag the pathogen first, right?
Yes, unless they're tagged like a kind of smart bomb needs a laser tag on it. If they're not tagged by virtue of being opsonized by complement and or antibody, then actually phagocytosis usually doesn't happen. So by blocking opsonization, Strep equi is able to very effectively persist despite a very fierce host immune response. These organisms are very efficient at recruiting neutrophils, which of course is what an abscess is. It's an accumulation of neutrophils, and yet are able to persist in the face of that neutrophil response. In group A streptococci, it's known that that group A streps also have mechanisms to allow them to survive within neutrophils having been phagocytosed. And we've done some work to assess whether that also happens with strep equi. And perhaps not surprisingly, these strep equi also has mechanisms to allow it to survive for some time within the neutrophil phagosome, having been phagocytosed. And it's not clear how important that this is in disease pathogenesis, whether these represent a means for trafficking of bacteria hidden within neutrophils around the horse or not, and that's a question which would be important to identify further. My hunch though is that actually it's probably a minor mechanism, and that the important mechanisms are simply the evasion of opsonization and phagocytosis from the start. So there's simply no interaction between neutrophils and the organism.
But I'm right in assuming that for many horses, actually, this persistent infection does not occur. Like many horses actually recover from the disease, is that right?
Yes, the large majority, and the data from the field surveys that the Animal Health Trust have conducted would suggest that possibly around 10% of recovered horses develop a carrier state. Mm-hmm.
Do we know whether that's a property of the horse or a property of the pathogen which determines whether persistent infection occurs? So does persistent infection occur in horses which are bad at fighting the
organism, or does it occur in horses which are infected by particularly cunning bacteria?
We know a little bit about virulence determinants for Strep equi, and not surprisingly, if you either make mutants in or find field isolates which are deficient in capsule or have M protein abnormalities, then these organisms cause less serious clinical disease. But there's no evidence that these organisms are less likely to produce a carrier state. Now, in truth, because the carrier state is difficult to detect, it's not absolutely clear in most outbreak situations how many carriers you have at the end of it, nor what the genotypes of the infective organisms were. There is a project ongoing at the Animal Health Trust at the moment, which is funded by the Horse Trust, which addresses this question and is collecting both bacteria and serum samples from a very large number of horses which are recovered from strangles. The target is to collect samples from 1,000 recovered horses, which we would hope would include around about 100 carriers. And the aim there is to look both at the organism but also at the host immune response, because as you mentioned in your question, this might be a property of the bacterium or of the horse. And historically, the attempts to look at differences between the horse's immune response comparing recovered normal animals to recovered carrier horses has not revealed any differences. But I suspect this may be historically because the immunological tools to look at the immune response were fairly blunt and looked at things like total antibody responses measured by complement fixing antibody, for example, which is not going to give you an idea of different components of the humoral immune response. And one thing that this current project is doing is looking at the immune response to a large number of surface proteins of the organism, the hope being that there may be differences if you look in detail at specific proteins on the surface of the organism, that there will be certain differences in between the immune response of a horse which recovers completely and one which recovers clinically but continues to carry organisms in its guttural pouch. The tricky thing might be, though, that actually this is a mucosal phenomenon rather than a circulating phenomenon, so there's still a possibility that the answer will be elusive, because we're still short of reagents and tools for looking at the mucosal immune response in horses in detail.
The fact that there is scope for developing immunity against a natural infection in horses would, of course, suggest that you can develop vaccines against this disease. As far as I'm aware, there also have been a couple of vaccines in the market. But recently there's been more activity in trying to find better vaccines and more vaccines, which would probably help us to fight the disease. Can you tell us more about the strategies which researchers use to try and determine which are actually the surface molecules or the pathways in the bacteria which actually could be targeted by a vaccine or could be used as a vaccine?
Yes, certainly. And in introducing that topic, to amplify a little of what Josh has said, that the important point, I think, in relation to any vaccine is that the cell-mediated response or the T-cell response to a pathogen is generally much more robust where the vaccine is a live vaccine, so an attenuated or modified live vaccine, whereas an inactivated vaccine would generally stimulate a very strong humoral or antibody-based response, but a less strong T-cell response. The fundamental point, therefore, in relation to strangles is to establish in the natural disease whether the immune response is primarily antibody-driven or whether it's primarily T-cell-driven, a cell-mediated response, as that will direct the types of vaccines that one might wish to produce. In respect of the initial studies of strangles, and a number of these are quite historic studies now, it would appear that the immunity is of the duration of 4 years in some horses, and that is predominantly an antibody-driven immunity, which is very encouraging in respect of vaccine design, because it suggests that the development of inactivated vaccines is a good route to pursue. The majority of the vaccines to date have been inactivated. And it also suggests that if we can identify which proteins or genes of the bacterium are associated with the most robust antibody response, then those will be the genes or the proteins to use in recombinant inactivated vaccines, where a portion of the infectious agent is engineered into the vaccine. The earlier work in relation to strangles in that respect was relatively simple but nonetheless pioneering immunological work, which looked at individual proteins of the bacterium in respect of looking in the spontaneous immune response to see which immune responses were directed towards which proteins, and therefore by inference which proteins were the most immunogenic. And that work really concentrated upon the M protein of the bacterium, which I'll ask Josh to say a little bit more about, as he's an expert in this area.
Yes, so the initial attempts were very logical and fairly simple approach, which was to screen convalescent sera by Western blotting, by immunoprecipitation, to screen convalescent sera against whole protein preparations of the organism. And the result from this was that a single protein appeared to be immunodominant, and that's the M protein. And that would be entirely predictable, because that's also true for the group A streps in people, about which a great deal more is known. And so, not surprisingly, the first vaccine approaches were made using M protein. This is a subunit vaccine, a single protein vaccine, so it will be safe, it will not cause disease. And extensive testing in mice showed it to be protective, and so it was a thoroughly logical approach to take for vaccinating horses. Turned out, though, that this vaccine does not perform as well in horses as it does in mice. It does give a measure of protection, but is not protective. But nonetheless, these vaccines have been, M-protein vaccines have been available commercially in continental Europe, in the USA and Australia for almost 30 years now, and continue to be used, and are popular largely because they are safe. We're going to come on and talk about alternative vaccines a little later on, and I think safety issues are something that will come up in that discussion.
The other thing I was wondering about is whether now in the times that we have genomic and also genetic engineering tools at our hands, does that affect the way you do research at the time, or will that probably just lead to the fact that we won't be able to see the trees for the wood anymore?
But I think that's a great question, and it's perhaps worth pointing out that Strep equi has a particular place in history, being the first purely veterinary pathogen to be genome sequenced. This project was undertaken at the Sanger Institute just south of Cambridge. Since then, a very large number of veterinary pathogens have been sequenced or are in the process of being sequenced, but equi has that place in history.
And of course you were not involved in that.
Not directly. So yes, this does open up a lot of possibilities, and I think a very reasonable part question and part criticism of genomics work is, well, you know, it generates a lot of information, but what actually comes out of it? And I think the honest answer is that there is a huge promise for organisms like Strep equi, and actually a lot of work is ongoing. Probably the honest answer is that there's no actual usable output from this yet, but I'll give you some examples of the way in which this is used. Pre-genome, it was simply not possible to take a sensible look at the surface proteins that the bacterium has, whereas once we have the genome sequence, it's possible to predict all of the surface proteins which the organism is likely to have. And in fact, this is the basis for the project I was talking about earlier that's happening at the Animal Health Trust, to look at the differences, or the possible differences, in immune response between carriers and normal convalescent horses. That kind of approach simply would not be possible without a genome sequence. The other thing that the genome sequence allows you to do from the point of view of vaccine design is to look for likely virulence determinants, and to then think about constructing knockout live organisms, so organisms which do not contain those virulence determinants. So I think, on particularly for vaccine design, whether it's looking for candidate immunodominant surface proteins or whether it's looking for virulence determinants, the genome sequence makes all this possible and actually transforms what actually is largely fumbling around in the dark into having a very informed and purposeful approach to coming up with better designs of vaccine, which means both more effective but also safe.
So the two major tools which you possibly will be having at hand in the future would be, on the one hand, recombinant vaccines, and on the other hand, engineered attenuated live vaccines. I think you've touched upon it earlier again, but can we probably flag up even more what the differences between those are and the possible advantages and pitfalls of using these types of vaccines?
Yes, of course. The principal difference between a recombinant vaccine and an attenuated vaccine is, as Josh has alluded to, the recombinant vaccine is a vaccine where one has identified through research those parts of a microorganism which are most likely to be immunogenic and least likely to be pathogenic, so least likely in isolation to cause disease, and has engineered those genes or those proteins into a carrier, be that in some cases another virus, in most cases another virus, or another vector compound that enables those molecules to be administered to the host. That recombinant approach is rather different from the production of an attenuated live vaccine, where one's almost doing the converse. In an attenuated live vaccine, one is trying to remove, again through knowledge obtained from research, those parts of the microorganism which are particularly associated with disease, in order to render that vaccine safe. The tightrope there, or the seesaw, upon which one is balancing, however, is that very often in removing those components of the microorganism which are associated with the disease, one also removes the components which are associated with a robust immune response. Very often it would be the same gene or the same protein, which by virtue of causing particularly severe damage also particularly stimulates a particularly robust immune response. So this for researchers is a continual challenge, I think, to achieve that balance.
Yeah, I think that's a really good explanation, and I think a good example of an actual mechanism that's relevant here would be to take capsule and M protein, which we talked about earlier. If you delete capsule and M protein, you have highly attenuated organisms, but M protein is although it's not responsible for protective immunity, it is one of the major proteins that the horse sees, and so by deleting that, we're removing one of the principal immunogens. And secondly, capsule is responsible for a measure of bacterial persistence, and so if we put in capsule-less organisms, they're removed from the horse very quickly, and so you might expect that actually there'll be less time for the immune response to be generated. And so, as Ken said, it is very much a tightrope between removing virulence determinants so you have a safe organism, but still having an organism which persists for long enough and which looks enough like the unattenuated organism to produce a lifelike protective immune response.
So the question I asked was probably slightly simplistic in asking which one would be the better one. I guess we have to make that decision based on the pathogen we're talking about, and it's probably a question of trying and seeing what happens.
It is. I mean, I guess from, you know, first principles, and perhaps if we leave safety to one side, then a live attenuated vaccine should be the more effective of the two, because provided you have made your deletions appropriately, then you would hopefully be able to generate all aspects of the immune response that would happen in response to natural infection. Humoral we know about, and possibly even cellular, although as Ken mentioned earlier, it would appear that cellular immunity is not particularly important with this organism. Recombinant vaccines, on the other hand, should be very safe, but then, you know, you have to try and make sure that you have all of the components of the organism present to generate the response that you need.
One interesting thing I came across when I looked at the area was that there seems to be a vaccine in the market at the moment which has to be applied into the lip. I was just wondering, why is such a, well, unusual way of administration necessary in a vaccine?
Another good question, and this is actually a very interesting vaccine. The background to this is actually based on technologies which have been used for human vaccines, most particularly Salmonella typhi. and is based around the deletion of a gene that codes for an enzyme that's critical in aromatic amino acid biosynthesis. Microbes, unlike mammals, need a significant amount of aromatic amino acids to conduct their metabolism properly. And as you might remember, aromatic amino acids are actually harmful to mammals. So mammal tissues and mammal body fluids contain very small amounts of aromatic amino acids, but microbes need them in order to grow. And so all microbes possess biosynthesis pathways. And a very effective way of attenuating organisms in a mammal host is to prevent the organism from being able to synthesize aromatic amino acids. And the first gene in a very long pathway is the ARO-A gene, and there's been a very successful global vaccine for Salmonella typhi based on an ARO-A deletion. And there have been other successful vaccines with other medical microbes. And the ARO-A deletion is the basis for this particular vaccine. So it's a very logical approach, and a single gene deletion was made in the ARO-A gene. The difficulty came when it came to finding a safe route of administering it, because intramuscular injection caused abscesses to form, and intranasal administration was ineffective at producing a protective immune response. And the route which was acceptable was, although it's a novel administration route, was injection into the lip, an intramucosal injection. And in fact, the immune response this generates appears to be identical to that that's generated following intramuscular injection. So it's not the case that this is generating local mucosal immunity, rather it's generating a systemic circulating antibody response, perhaps with secretion of antibody into the respiratory tract, although that's not been measured. And this delivery route really was necessary to find a safe route of administration, which also was protective. I think the company were very pleased with the public acceptance and compliance with this route, and actually I think once people got used to the idea of having this alternative administration route, there were very few problems from the point of view of owner compliance or willingness to have the administration done. So I think it's an interesting approach, but actually it's generating an immune response that is essentially the same as giving the vaccine IM. But the important step forwards, I think, with this vaccine is that firstly it's a genetically modified organism, and it's perhaps worth pausing for a second to consider how few genetically modified organisms we have in the marketplace for vaccines, particularly in Europe, where this is the first, and so this in itself is quite a big step forwards. And I hope this will encourage other companies to develop the idea of live attenuated vaccines, either for this organism or for other organisms, because for respiratory agents in particular, the live attenuated route, particularly delivered intranasally, is the sensible way forwards.
Ken, as a pathologist, do you have any explanation why, despite the fact that we cause a systemic immune response with this local application of the vaccine, we don't see the abscesses and the side effects we probably see when we apply the vaccine intramuscularly?
I think there are one or two possible explanations for that difference, principally anatomical, I suspect. As Josh has explained, the vaccine is administered in relatively small volume into the submucosal or the intramucosal portion of the lip, which is quite different from the situation where one would be delivering an intramuscular vaccine into an area of well-vascularized muscle within a connective tissue compartment that would be susceptible to abscessation, and also quite different from the natural route of infection of a lymph node, where there are large numbers of resident leukocytes and to which site neutrophils can be recruited relatively quickly. So there are anatomical reasons why labial abscessation is less likely. I would perhaps qualify some of the statements which I previously made in relation to the intramucosal route being entirely without the risk of abscessation, in the sense that there is more than theoretical risk of small abscesses forming at the site of vaccine administration. And the importance of that, I think, is perhaps in educating horse owners that in order to establish a robust immune response, it may be that small areas of abscessation will form at the vaccine site. But what one would not anticipate is the large abscesses and sinus tracts that are a hallmark of strangles as a natural disease, which might rupture.
Quite obvious.
Exactly so.
Yeah, if I could just add to that, I think that's absolutely right. And one of the features of this from the test data that the company produced is that there are small abscesses visible histologically at the injection site. When the vaccine went into commercial use and you then scale up from a small-scale testing through to having thousands and thousands of doses administered, perhaps not surprisingly, some horses went on to develop full abscesses. And one of the adverse reactions to the vaccine that is documented and is documented in a few individual horses is the appearance of quite significant lip swelling, and in a small number of horses, I haven't got the numbers to hand, but in a small number, actual abscesses with pus and drainage from the site.
Well, thank you very much for all that information you gave us, Ken and Josh. And I have to say, there seem to be many, many routes which you most likely will be taking in the future to drive this field further. I'd like to wish you all the best of luck for that. And again, thank you for joining us here today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it from us for today. Please check out our webpage again in 2 weeks for our new episode, or alternatively, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, which will guarantee that you won't miss a single episode in the future. In the meantime, if you have any feedback, please send it to podcast@rvc.ac.uk. Goodbye.